Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Lee Wentz, and I represent the appellant, Eric Phillips. And I'll try to stick with the terminology used in the briefing and in the trial court's opinion as much as possible today, and I will often refer to the appellant as the plaintiff and the appellees as the defendants. And I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, if I may. Before jumping into the issues on appeal, I'd like to first give a little bit of background to help the court understand why these issues are important and the errors that were made at the trial court. The underlying business transaction in this case began with deception. David Schifino misrepresented his intentions and lied about where his money was coming from. He entered into a secret agreement with Steve Hove with the ultimate goal in this case, and what the trial court in a number of places stated the real goal of the defendants is to wrestle away control of the domain name candles.com from Mr. Phillips. Mr. Phillips purchased candles.com back in, I think, 1998, when interstate commerce was first really beginning. And today, it's worth a lot more money. And that's always been the ultimate goal here. In pursuit of that goal, once the company here was formed, GMB LLC, Mr. Phillips was systematically locked out. He had bargained for the right to appoint 3 members of the board, and those appointments were blocked by Mr. Schifino. He had bargained for the right to be the vice president of purchasing. And
just so we can focus, that is, to understand how the facts relate to the issues,
mm-hmm.
Did the facts that you're reciting to us relate to the holding of the court that both parties were liable and had to account to the limited partnership, but there was no claim for damages, that is, that they were not otherwise liable to each other?
Ultimately, these facts go to the issue of who the original voting members of GNB LLC were.
Whether it was...
And the issues of prior breach.
Okay. Whether it was Serafino or personally or individually or the firehouse, right?
Exactly. The reason it's important that Mr. Phillips was locked out because he was the only person there who knew anything about the online candle business. He had started Wixen.com from scratch, grew it into a profitable small business. He knew the purchasers, he knew the customers, he knew the online marketing, and he was never allowed to participate in the management of the company. And eventually, he filed his original complaint in the Court of Chancery, seeking declaratory relief that he was, well, that the original voting members of GNB were Eric Phillips and David Schifino.
You don't challenge the earlier determination by the Court of Chancery that the agreement was ambiguous?
No, Your Honor.
So when the application of extrinsic evidence is made to decide the issue, what is our standard of review?
I don't think that I'm so far apart with the defendants' counsel on this issue. The standard of review when interpreting an ambiguous contractual provision is that the court knows no deference to the trial court's conclusions. The conclusions that are based on legal conclusions, the conclusions based upon findings of fact, need to be supported by the record and the product of an orderly and logical deductive process. And in this case, the trial court did not follow an orderly and logical deductive process in examining the extrinsic evidence.
I'm not sure I get that. Your issue here, your claim here is that Schifino individually was an original member together with Phillips, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And once Schifino dropped out of the picture and assigned his interests, the only person left with voting power was your client, Mr. Phillips.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay. The court disagreed and found that Firehouse was an original member and still is a member and therefore is a 50%, has 50% of the votes. What was the error in concluding that?
The error was in concluding that Firehouse was an original voting member.
I understand that, but yeah. Why was that an error?
Well, for example, the reason this issue is so important is because of what you just mentioned, that if...
Whether your client has 100% control or whether there's a deadlock, I understand that.
Yes. And whether Mr. Phillips has the right to appoint the board.
Okay, but what was the legal error that you're claiming in holding, as the court did, that Firehouse and not Schifino was the original member?
That the trial court's use of the extrinsic evidence was not supported by the record, and that it wasn't the product of an orderly and logical deductive process.
By use, do you mean the conclusion reached was incorrect or erroneous based on the extrinsic evidence used, or using certain extrinsic evidence was inappropriate?
Both, Your Honor.
Well, tell us how, because I think that's the question Justice Jacobs is trying to reach.
Okay. If I may, I think one piece of evidence that helps shed light on this is what was Joint Exhibit 39. It was the purported assignment from David Schifino to Firehouse of Schifino, personally, of Schifino's interests in GMB LLC. Right. The conclusion reached by the trial court was that Firehouse was the original voting member. Right. So the question is, how could that be logical and orderly and make sense of this piece of evidence? This piece of evidence purports to be an assignment from David Schifino personally to Firehouse. The trial court has rewritten it to be an assignment from Firehouse to itself, unnecessarily, and for reasons that are inexplicable. And
so you're not claiming that the agreement by its own terms and without regard to extrinsic evidence establishes that Schifino is the original member. I mean, you concede, at least for this purpose, that there's ambiguity, but argue that the courts resort to extrinsic evidence, while proper abstractly, was incorrect in this particular case.
That yes, is, Your Honor.
Found the wrong facts.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes,
okay.
Your Honor.
So basically, the standard of review is whether there's any credible evidence to support the conclusion that Firehouse was an original member, and you're claiming that there's none?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. The trial court specifically found that David Schifino's testimony was not credible unless it was corroborated by other evidence. So the documents used are all important. One document used was Joint Trial Exhibit 188. It was a draft purchase option for the domain, one of the domain names. That joint trial exhibit, at no place mentions the David Schifino's investment entity, Firehouse. It can't support the trial court's conclusion that Firehouse was an original voting member. And the court basically looked at it and said, well, if Firehouse is a signatory, therefore, that's some extrinsic evidence that Firehouse was intended to be an original voting member. But Firehouse is not a signatory to that agreement.
Well, isn't it clear on this record that there's evidence going both ways?
There's overwhelming evidence going one way and a handful of very sketchy documents going the other way.
Okay, so the issue then is whether the evidence that goes the way the court found is whether it's a handful constitutes enough, correct?
Whether the evidence is valid, whether it's real evidence. The trial court relied upon, you know, a draft agreement that was never signed, but was intended to be signed by David Schifino. It read that as something that had been intended to be signed by Firehouse. The reason is because there was an earlier version of that document that had been submitted to the trial court in one of the two ways of falsifying and backdating documents that the defendants engaged in during the litigation in this case. That's why
the Court of Chancery also had credibility issues with your client. True.
Yes, some.
Doesn't that problem support different views of the evidence? So that if there's two different views of the evidence, there's not a clearly erroneous factual determination?
But the trial court didn't need to rely upon Mr. Phillips' testimony. it thought at times Mr. Phillips' testimony was not credible, but there was overwhelming documentary evidence throughout the case that David Schifino acted and represented himself to be the original voting member of GMB. He applied to the IRS, he applied for bank accounts, he executed this assignment that the court was trying to understand. You know, what is the import and impact of this assignment, of his interest to Firehouse? If Firehouse was an original voting member, David Schifino engaged in this wholly unnecessary exercise for reasons that are left mysterious. And I'm really, you know, I'm curious and eager to understand.
Well, the reason was that he had just had enough in terms of the infighting, wanted to walk away, had the opportunity to walk away and get paid, you know, whatever value he was able to extract from Mr. Hove. So, you know, what's unreasonable about that?
Well, the assignment in question was executed before this case became that contentious. It was contentious, but there was no litigation at that point.
Well, he assigned his interest to Firehouse, right?
Exactly.
Okay. That
exactly. That he assigned his interest
to Firehouse. That supports the claim that Firehouse was to be an original member. Later, after all the contention broke out, he assigned his interest in Firehouse to Mr. Hove and walked away. Now, those facts together and apart support the conclusion the trial judge reached, don't they?
No, Your Honor, I disagree. In the first assignment, Mr. Schifino executed it personally as an assignment of his interest to Firehouse. Now, on the trial court's reading, that's an assignment from Firehouse to Firehouse. The trial court held that all of these subsequent transactions took place at the level of Firehouse, so to speak.
Well, maybe the difficulty I'm having is understanding what you believe an assignment accomplishes as a matter of law and what I may misunderstand an assignment to accomplish as a matter of law. If he's assigning his interest, I understand you to be telling us that must establish and can only establish that he was an original voter, and that Firehouse could not have been. Otherwise, that right wouldn't have been assigned to them at a later time. I think that's what you're saying. But isn't an assignment all about taking whatever interest one had and assigning it to someone else, putting that assignee in the same shoes as the assignor from day one?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think the point is David Schifino had something to assign. He had interest. That's why he found the need to do this. And the only way he would have had any interest is if he was an original voting member, as the rest of the evidence indicates. My time is running short. May I briefly turn to the second issue on appeal?
Yes.
There's been some confusion about whether this argument was raised, and it concerns the other domain names. Section 5 of the GMB agreement purports to sell or transfer all of the assets used by Wick's End in the retail and wholesale candle business. In the briefing in this case, the plaintiffs argued that the defendants aren't entitled to enforce Section 5, really specifically or otherwise, because they committed prior breaches of the agreement. You know, they can't breach the agreement and then stand and insist on specific performance by the other party.
I'm sorry, your claim is that your client never transferred the domain names. They don't belong to Candles.com?
They don't belong to GMB LLC.
GMB LLC. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Your colleague has risen. Let me stop your time for a minute and find out why.
Okay.
Your Honor, in the appellee's response, we had argued that this issue was not properly raised before the trial court. I am withdrawing that argument and don't wish Mr. Wentz to spend any of his time on the issue that he was never properly raised in the Chancery Court. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I don't know why the argument wasn't addressed.
What was your request? That we remand so that it is addressed?
I would, at the very least, Your Honor, I think the evidence is clear that the court could hold that there were prior breaches committed. It's clear that Mr. Phillips was locked out, that he wasn't allowed to appoint a board of directors as he had bargained for. He wasn't allowed to be the vice president of purchasing as he had bargained for, and other breaches. But the ancillary documents that the GMB agreement called for were never executed because David Schifino didn't want to execute them. All of these, I think, are clear instances of breach that the court could find. And
the consequence of that would be, how is that relevant as to candles.com and the other domain names?
It's relevant to the other domain names because it would mean that the provision that purports to transfer them could not be enforced against Mr. Phillips.
But the candles.com still can be?
That was covered by other provisions in the GMB agreement.
Do you want to save your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Just as a matter of convenience, I noticed from time to time you were leaning into the mic. That podium does go up and down if it's easier for you when you come back on rebuttal. I didn't want to interrupt your argument and point that out.
Okay.
But it looked like you were trying to get to the mic, but it will, go higher.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Ridgely, and Justice Jacobs. I've had you in law school and suddenly forgot your name. May it please the court, my name is Bernard Conaway. I represent the appellates, Firehouse Galleries, LLC, and Stephen Hove. The crux of the argument before the court today is twofold, first of which is whether or not there were facts of record to support the trial court's conclusions as reflected in the memorandum opinion. What the appellant has tried to argue here, well, at least in the factual context, is that there were only two documents with which the court could have relied upon to reach the conclusions that it did. That, however, is wildly inconsistent with what occurred at trial and the evidence that were presented at trial. I believe it was Justice Jacobs pointed out, I think correctly, that there were any number of exhibits that could be interpreted in any number of ways to reach any number of conclusions. The question before this court is whether or not there are facts of record to support the logical and rational deductive process to reach a conclusion. Herein lies the crux of the problem with the appellant's appeal. There are facts that support the Chancery Court's decision that GNB was owned at the outset by both Mr. Phillips and Firehouse. While we can agree that some documents may say, or at least point in one direction, others may point in another direction, at the end of the day, it was within the province of the Court of Chancery to review those documents, listen to the witnesses, consider them, reason through them, and draw the conclusions that it thought appropriate. What this court has not heard and has not seen in the briefing is any place where the court did not do such. All we've heard is the conclusory allegation that the court made a mistake on the facts.
What was the timing? That is, if on day one GNB LLC is created legally, and if Firehouse was one of the original members, what interest did it hold, and what interest did Mr. Schifino hold?
Mr. Schifino held no direct interest. Whatever interest Mr. Schifino held, he held through Firehouse.
He had some security that represented an interest in Firehouse.
He was a member of Firehouse. My recollection, Your Honor, is
he had a membership interest in Firehouse.
He had a membership interest. He was the dominant member. I believe the allocation was at the conclusion. He held a 51% interest in Firehouse.
Right, and Hove 49.
Hove 49%.
And then sometime after that, Mr. Schifino assigned his membership interest in Firehouse back to Firehouse?
Correct.
Okay. And then, was there another assignment? At that point, was Mr. Schifino out of the picture altogether?
Just to be clear, in the context of GNB, Mr. Schifino was never in the ownership, direct ownership
position.
Right.
Whatever interest he held through Firehouse. In January of 2008, he effected a transfer of his interest in Firehouse, effectively to Mr. Hove. At that point, Mr. Hove became the sole owner of Firehouse. Now, that did not change the dynamic of ownership.
Okay, so there were not two assignments by Mr. Schifino, just one. And it was an assignment to Mr. Hove?
Your Honor, as is too often the case here, there is not clarity, excuse me, in the assignment. There were, in effect, two assignments that occurred at the same time. Mr. Hove, or Mr. Schifino, conveyed his interest to Mr. Hove, and he conveyed his interest to Firehouse. What the appellant has done is hung his hat on this, what is described as inexplicable assignment from Firehouse to Firehouse. But there were never, outside of that arrangement, there were not two transfers, if I'm answering your question, Your Honor.
Well, the only thing that Mr. Schifino had that he could transfer was his interest in Firehouse.
That's correct.
And he either could surrender that to Firehouse, which would mean Firehouse is buying him out, or he could surrender it to Mr. Hove. Which was it?
He did both. Mr. Hove paid. I agree, Your Honor.
That's inexplicable.
It's not a transaction that I think most lawyers would have conjured up, would have structured. But the fact of the matter is, much about this case has not been done by according to the rules of FOIL. The long and the short of it is that Mr. Schifino transferred his interest to Mr. Hove for significant consideration. There were monies paid at that point, and there was a note that was given by Mr. Hove to Mr. Schifino in consideration for Mr. Schifino's interest in Firehouse.
What is your position on the prior material breach, and should we remand that?
Because no.
The other side says that's important to the other domain names.
I apologize. I have to confess that when I saw this argument, it didn't resonate with me. And the reason it didn't resonate with me is this. The claim for the return of the domain names was a derivative claim that Firehouse had asserted on behalf of GNB. It would be our contention, and I think the court understood this, that Mr. Hove's conduct, whatever it may be, had no bearing on Firehouse's right to assert on behalf of GNB the right to enforce the agreement. In enforcing the agreement, the domain names would have inured to the benefit of GNB, not Mr. Hove. And it was on the basis of that intellectual jumbling that I concluded that argument had not been raised. The fact of the matter is, there are two points here to make. One of which is, while the court was critical of all of the witnesses and all of the players here, it did not determine that Mr. Hove had participated or conducted himself in a manner that would be described as unclean hands. So even if the court were to conclude that this was an action that Mr. Hove intended to pursue for his own benefits, the argument that he had engaged in unclean hands, as it was raised by the plaintiff at that point in the trial court, would have not been applicable in as much as it wasn't Mr. Hove making the claim. It was Firehouse.
Well, it's as far as the other domain names are concerned, it isn't clear what value, if any, they have. What is clear from the court's determination is that the domain name candles.com had a lot of value, and therefore, you know, a critical issue was whether candles.com continued to have the contractual right to use that domain name or whether that right had been terminated. And that got the court into this issue of what effect the bankruptcy had. My question is that an issue that we need to determine? The Vice Chancellor looked both at federal law and Delaware law and determined that at least as long as the bankruptcy was legally alive, an executory contract like that could not be terminated. That is, the ipso facto clause did not operate validly. Then the bankruptcy gets dismissed, and there's argument in the brief that at that point, since there was no bankruptcy, but there had been a bankruptcy that had been filed, that Mr. Phillips would have had the contractual right to terminate the agreement and get back his right, exclusive right, to use the domain name. That much is, I understand. But the trial court also held, citing two chancery cases, that those ipso facto clauses are not valid in any event. And my question is that an issue that we have to decide as a matter of first impression or not?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. I think what we're all clear on is that walking into the door of bankruptcy, GNB availed itself of the automatic stay. Shortly after the bankruptcy was commenced, Mr. Phillips repointed the domain name. That's essentially taking it and pointing it from the place of one business to another business. There was a mad rush back into the bankruptcy court. The bankruptcy court ordered that the domain name be pointed back. Now, as best I am able to ascertain from the docket there, it did so under Section 365 of the Bankruptcy Code. That code, that section prohibits the execution of these ipso facto clauses. Now, having said all of that,
during bankruptcy,
and the point here is that
let's clear that away. Let's assume there had never been a bankruptcy.
Okay.
Well, I guess we can't, can we? Because then the ipso facto clause would make no sense. So there was a bankruptcy; it gets dismissed. Now we're out of bankruptcy. Why couldn't Mr. Phillips terminate the exclusive use license?
He could, Your Honor. There were two ways in which Mr. Phillips could have terminated the agreement, one of which was upon the filing of the bankruptcy or upon the happening of the bankruptcy. The second was if the business stopped doing business. What the court concluded, the Chancery Court concluded, was that while in bankruptcy, Mr. Phillips was unable to avail himself of the bankruptcy trigger. Once he exited bankruptcy, however, he was able to pull the trigger, the other trigger, which was the failure to do business. The court specifically found that he never did that, Your Honor.
Well, why couldn't he exercise the bankruptcy trigger? Because there had been a bankruptcy filing.
But they weren't in bankruptcy at that point. And I think where we find some confusion in the case law, and the appellates pointed it out, Milford Power, a case decided by Chancellor Strine, walk through a significant analysis under 365, under Delaware's LLC Act, came to the conclusion in that particular case that the execution of that sort of ipso facto clause was inconsistent with Delaware LLC law. Now, the fundamental difference between that case and this case is the language of the LLC agreement in the Milford Power case was dramatically more detailed. It was fleshed out. It talked about the assignment of or not the assignment, that upon the trigger, the execution of the trigger, that the management of that LLC would then be transferred to another party. And it was that particular provision that the court found.
Yes, well, that's very granular, but none of that detail appears in Vice Chancellor Laster's opinion. All he did was to cite two Chancery cases and said these clauses are not enforceable. And I understood that to mean, maybe wrongly, that they're not enforceable in bankruptcy or out of bankruptcy or before bankruptcy. It's basically a non-fact. If they are enforceable after bankruptcy, whether because we disagree with those cases or because those cases are distinguishable, that's an issue that we have to address or not.
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
And all right, the question is why, and I'm still not sure what your answer is.
Yeah, maybe I got a little long-winded and let myself get away with it here. The long and the short of it is, if I understand the Chancery Court opinion, the court read the agreement in a very simplistic fashion because of its confusion, and ultimately, I think, came to the conclusion that in the absence of being in bankruptcy, you couldn't pull the bankruptcy trigger. And that's why the court went on to discuss.
That's catch 22, though.
It may very well be.
You know, if you're not in bankruptcy, you can't pull the trigger. If you are in bankruptcy, under federal law, you can't pull the trigger. There's no trigger.
There is no trigger, but that, unfortunately, is what Section 365 of the Bankruptcy Code does to a lot of these ipso facto clauses.
Well,
it eviscerates them.
There's a Superior Court opinion of Judge Bifferato in Chrysler Financial, which actually was affirmed by this court.
Correct, Your Honor.
And why doesn't that control?
Because what happened in that case was the debtor filed bankruptcy. There was an ipso facto clause there. The debtor could not execute it while it was in bankruptcy. Upon exit from bankruptcy, it didn't. The party capable of executing or pulling the trigger didn't. What the court in Judge Bifferato said was that if there was a secondary instance of insolvency or bankruptcy, that they could pull it then. What happened in that case was that, if I recall the facts correctly, was that the debtor filed suit. It was at that point that the person holding the trigger was able to pull it. And Judge Bifferato said, under those circumstances, you may pull the trigger on a bankruptcy insolvency sort of position because you're not in bankruptcy.
Two questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
You've spoken about that Superior Court case and at least one of the Chancery cases in great factual detail. Does that detail emerge from the briefs? Was it briefed, or is this something that we're sort of hearing for the first time?
The
short answer.
No, it was not briefed in detail, Your Honor.
Okay. Second question is, and this gets back to the other trigger, which was cease doing business. As I understand it, the only item that gives value, that injects value into the LLC, GNP or whatever the name is, GNB, is the Candles.com domain name.
Not entirely correct, Your Honor.
Well, the right to use it. But that's true only if there's a business that's associated with that name. The court found that domain name and the business associated with it might be worth up to $2 million. That suggests that there was no factual basis to pull the stop doing business trigger. The only trigger, if any, that would exist would be the bankruptcy trigger. And that's the reason why I'm raising the question of the importance of that issue, because turning on that issue would be whether or not this limited partnership has anything of value.
There are, my recollection's not clear, Your Honor, 18 different domain names here.
Yeah, but the one that counts is Candles.com, because the rest of them point to candles, don't they?
There's another one that was in business, wixen.com, Your Honor, that had been in business on its own and of its own for many years and had generated business. To specifically answer your question, there was not the kind of extensive briefing or discussion about the bankruptcy trigger issue in the Chancery Court that might answer the kinds of questions that Your Honor is asking.
Maybe I don't understand the significance of candles.com as a non-candle user, but it strikes me that the briefs suggest and the exhibits suggest that the mere ownership of candles.com is of value whether there's a business behind it or not. Somebody would buy that domain and begin a business under that domain and find it valuable. Is that wrong?
No, that's correct, Your Honor. Candles.com is one of a number of internet domain names that are referred to as generic first tier. Cars.com, magazines.com. They are the kinds of internet names that when people go looking for that particular object, they type the word candle in and Google shoots you off to the most appropriate matching domain name, which in this case happens to be candles. So if you are in the candle business and you want to generate traffic to your website, which is the equivalent of customers walking in and out the door, you want that domain name, and it by itself has value just by virtue of the name.
Sort of a Roman candle.
Under the Chancery's ruling with the liquidation then, as it stands, candles.com is going to be sold?
No, Your Honor.
No?
Candles.com is subject to two different provisions, or two other provisions in the agreement. Those provisions create both a sale option and a license option. The Chancery Court had previously held that candles.com was subject to paragraphs 3 and 4 of the February 20, 2007 agreement. It was not subject to paragraph 5, which is the paragraph of the agreement that transfers all of these other domain names. So in the liquidation process, what the liquidator has in his hands, Mr. McBride. He has these 17 domain names. He has an option to buy candles.com, and he has a license to use candles.com, provided the contractual conditions are complied with.
So the way the Vice Chancellor's ruling left this issue and left the parties was that if, as appears to be the case at this moment, Mr. Phillips doesn't have the exclusive right to use candles.com, then he has a claim for damages, he would have a claim for damages against somebody because he's entitled to compensation, for having the LLC have the right to use that that domain name. Is that right?
I'm not sure I'm following, Your Honor. If I could restate.
Okay, well, either Mr. Phillips owns and has exclusive right to use the candles.com domain name or he doesn't. If he does, then he could do with that domain name what he wishes. If he doesn't, since he did have ownership, but use has now been contracted out, he's entitled to be compensated for that use. And he hasn't been compensated yet. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. The February 20th agreement does a couple of things with candles.com. First, it transfers a five-year free license to GNV. That right expired, I believe, on February 20th of 2012. So from February 20th of 2007 to 2012, GNV had the unfettered right to use it without compensation directly related to the use. Now, there were other forms of compensation that the agreement got into, but I'll leave those alone. The second part of
Is that agreement now terminated?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I thought you said expired by its own terms in February.
There's an issue, at least in the liquidator's mind, whether or not the agreement should have been extended by virtue of the misappropriation of that by Mr. Phillips.
Thank you very much.
I've got 49 seconds, if I might summarize very briefly.
You're 54 seconds into your red light.
Well, I'm sorry.
I do have one question.
Well, that gives you more time.
Another day to live. Thank you. Yes, Your Honor.
You're asking us to affirm. Are we required by doing so to overrule Chrysler Financial?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. Not at all.
And why not?
Because on facts, they are different. On interpretation of an LLC agreement, they are different. There is a conceptual and fundamental difference between what happened in the Chancery Court decision and what happened here. In this case, there is no real LLC agreement. There is a document that is described as an agreement. In contrast, the Chancery Court had before a very detailed, very articulated process by which the triggers, the ipso facto triggers, could be pulled. There is nothing inconsistent about this case and holding that this agreement did not produce the same result as the agreement in Milford Power did. Have I answered your question?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I briefly touch on the bankruptcy issue and Chrysler Financial Corp? Yes, this court would have to overrule Chrysler Financial Corp to uphold the trial court's opinion in this case. The Superior Court in Chrysler Financial Corp went through a detailed analysis of other bankruptcy decisions, of the legislative history to Section 365 of the Bankruptcy Code, and concluded that ipso facto provisions are enforceable when the debtor emerges from bankruptcy in the absence of an order to the contrary. You know, if the bankruptcy judge orders that it can be enforced, then obviously it can't. The trial court, and unfortunately I compounded this mistake, the trial court read Milford Power as being inconsistent with Chrysler Financial. And in preparation for today's argument, I tried to read the opinions more carefully, and I don't think they're inconsistent. Milford Power, in Milford Power, the Court of Chancery partially enforced an ipso facto provision. It involved an LLC agreement and an assignment, and the court basically said that, yes, the
economic interests in the LLC were validly transferred. The ipso facto provision does not affect that, but it does prevent the voting interest from being transferred.
Is it your position that this is an issue, that is the issue of whether under state law, under Delaware law, an ipso facto provision is enforceable once an entity emerges from bankruptcy? Is that an issue that we need to deal with?
Yes, Your Honor. I think so. I think Chrysler Financial Corp. says that such provisions are enforceable when the debtor emerges from bankruptcy, absent an order to the contrary. Mifflin Power Court said that, you know, sometimes some provisions, that sometimes they are partially enforceable. The trial court read Milford Power as rejecting the reasoning of Chrysler Financial Corp. And again, I think I characterized it that way, and that was an error. It didn't really reject it. It merely gave a more limited and narrow holding. It had the trial court in Milford Power had other reasons for partially enforcing the ipso facto clause and partially letting it go. And it chose those narrower reasons. It had to do with the assumability, what are called assumability exceptions.
What you're telling us in your brief?
Yes, I think.
That level of detail?
Maybe not that level of detail. But I do point out that Chrysler Financial Corp. should be controlling authority here. It was a good opinion, and it was affirmed by this court. The Court of Chancery shouldn't have rejected it. In fact, it hadn't rejected it before. And in this case, in particular, when the bankruptcy was a sham, it shouldn't be enforced. The trial court was clear that the bankruptcy was unauthorized and filed in bad faith so that Hove and Schifino could retain control of GMB and get this case into a Florida forum.
Well, if this is a live issue, I gather it's because there the agreement under which the LLC, that is GMB LLC, has the right to use the domain name has not expired. Otherwise, why do we care?
The purchase option should have expired in February 20th, but there are ongoing issues about this in the liquidation process and arguments that no, in fact, it didn't expire. That's why it needed to be briefed and hopefully brought to an end.
And the Court of Chancery has not addressed that?
Not to my knowledge, not yet, Your Honor. But I have to admit that I'm not representing Mr. Phillips in the liquidation process. I'm trying to keep apprised of it, but it's not my primary sort of function. And with that, I'll conclude.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.